Welcome to the Rest of Us in Tech podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Withy, and today I'm here with B. Cordelia Yu. Hi, Cordelia.
Hello.
How are you?
Lovely.
That's great. A little bit about Cordelia. They are a content and editorial strategist and independent researcher at the intersection of social justice, civic tech, public policy, and digital design. They help organizations build inclusive editorial teams and products to foster democratic communities and expanding access to communities of knowledge. Their research is in creating models for open governance and technology-mediated deliberative democratic practices. Cordelia cohabitates with two bunnies who have no patience for authoritarian shenanigans. How'd I do?
Awesome.
It's a lot of big words to throw into a bio. So tell me a little bit about, what does a content and editorial strategist do?
So the way I practice content strategy, which is content strategy is maturing to the point where like we're sort of growing into subfields, which is awesome because like content and the way you talk to people is really important and complicated. So the way I practice it is I do a lot of stuff around how organizations and companies build workflows for creating content and communicating to their audiences and constituencies. So a lot of stuff might include doing a content audit of all of a company's content, their website, their print brochures, etc. And going, all right, this sucks. That's pretty good. And sort of tease out what makes how good content was made and how bad content can be improved. And for me, I like working on the people bits of building the people bits. So like how people go about writing, whether or not we're emailing Word docs back and forth with underscore final, underscore version 3, underscore really this time, underscore version 2, or if we're, you know, using better processes to do things like that.
And how long have you been doing work like this?
8-ish years. I came out of public policy and then went into sort of doing web design and digital strategy for nonprofits. And like that sort of grew into me concentrating on content strategy. So it's like, there are gray areas in my resume.
So you also said you do some independent research at the intersection of social justice, civic tech, public policy, and digital design. Could you maybe explain briefly what kind of research you do?
Most recently, I've been doing a lot of research around deliberative democracy practices and how technology can be used to sort of expand public access to substantive policymaking. Right now in the US, normally what happens is a Congress critter will go, hey, I want to do a thing. And then they go into a back room and sort of get a bunch of other Congress critters together and write a thing. And then they start pushing it pushing legislation through. And honestly, that's a really bad way to perform democracy. It's not particularly democratic. But what Taiwan has been doing is they'll go, hey, people care about a thing. And then they'll start putting together research, like with open government data. Ooh, transparency. What a wonderful idea in our government. And then they start like going out to academics and stakeholders and constituents and saying, you are an expert in this field, or you have a stake in this field. Come work with us, go through our data. We'll, if you don't know how, we'll teach you to read through it, and then we'll start holding community facilitated sessions to talk about what people think is important. And then they use that to go back and feed how legislation is crafted. And it's amazing that, like, in the mid-aughts, they were doing this by going into communities, and they're still doing that. Like, they're still saying, like, the person in-person, face-to-face meetings are the core of how deliberative democracy works. But then they're also building digital tools to go on top of that. So they started using, they built out a tool called VTaiwan, where anyone can go and look at what sort of policy issues are being considered. And at scale, like, this is what technology does. It makes things scalable. At scale, they get substantive public input and then use that to shape policymaking. Or for in-person meetings, they're essentially turning the meeting rooms and meeting halls into ambient readers where you have a whiteboard. Okay, instead of using a normal whiteboard, we'll use open source tools to build a digital whiteboard. So when you're writing stuff down, it's getting recorded, and so anyone who wasn't able to come is still able to see and still able to participate. And like, they're using technology to actually make democracy more inclusive. And that's beautiful. And it's kind of opposite from what a lot of our places are doing. So that's been my research.
Yeah, besides just, it seems like laws in the U.S. come because some congressperson decides they just want to do a thing and don't really seem to consult much outside of their own circles. I love the idea of taking technology and making it better overall. You know, it's not, you know, we have this power to collect massive amounts of data and process it. And, you know, also be able to connect with people all over the place really easily. And I love the idea that Taiwan is taking all of that and doing that, being able to connect with, you know, the populations and the people who vote and actually, you know, give them good sources to determine how they should vote and things like that.
So one thing that, like, I've been somewhat skeptical of, is VR, right? Like, VR is growing huge, and like, VR games are growing huge, and which is absolutely awesome, and that's fun and fantastic. But I was like, for the longest time, I was like, so how is this going to be anything but a rich person's plaything? And then their digital minister, Audrey Tang, who is a hacker who led the development of PUGs for Perl 6. So she is a person who, like, our community knows really well. And she started talking about they're using VR for bringing people into meetings. For instance, like, you're going to have a meeting and someone who has a disability of some sort can't get to the meeting. Well, give them a VR headset, make the room, make a VR version of the meeting room, and like, put a 360 degree camera right where they would physically be sitting around the table. And then suddenly you bring a person who literally cannot get into the room otherwise into the room with a face, who is suddenly sitting there with the president of Taiwan, with the ministry of policymakers, with the activists, and going, hey, I deserve a seat at this table, and I'm now here. And it completely changes, like, who is allowed into the room. And, like, suddenly I'm like, oh, VR can actually, like, radically change how democracy happens. And I'm like, this is brilliant. It's, yeah.
And one of the things I'm thinking of as you're talking about that is, if you're talking about a person virtually being in a room, that's almost like one directional. But if they're able to ask anybody in the room a question too from their home, then all of a sudden you are, you know, there's that bidirectional. Like, they're a part of the meeting and the meeting is in their space too.
Yeah, I didn't really get it until until seeing that happen. And wow. Like, wow.
And there's, I know a lot of tech in, like you said, kind of like rich people toys, but I love hearing about tech used to basically enable people that wouldn't be able to do certain things otherwise.
It feels obvious, and in other ways it feels like completely revolutionary, in that in doing this, Taiwan is only using open source software. They're doing it that way explicitly because they want anyone to be able to access it, and anyone to be able to, if they feel the way things are being done is wrong, they can take the software, spin up their own, and say, hey, you need to come in, listen to us. And then they do. Yeah. And like for meeting notes and capturing transcriptions and stuff like that, instead of, say, using Dropbox and Google Docs and a million other things, they invested, they put resources into continuing development for Sandstorm.io. Like, this is what we're going to use. And there's this suite there, and we're going to support its development. And holy crap. Wow.
So you've been doing this research into other different ways technology can be used to help democracy in the general population and stuff like that. How do you see this research being applied to, you know, U.S. politics? And I should point out that you are in the U.S. currently.
Right. So there are a lot of groups in the U.S. thinking about this stuff. And one group in particular is Civic Hall in New York. And they're thinking about how to expand what Taiwan is doing to local decision-making in New York. One of the tools that they use in Taiwan to build vTaiwan is actually created by a startup in Seattle called Polis, P-O-L.I-S. Polis was actually open source because Taiwan asked them to. But I was talking to their founder, Colin McGill, and he's saying that, like, he's now talking to communities here, not just in liberal spaces, but like even towns in Alabama who are going, we are having huge deadlock around like local policymaking. We need tools to like be able to let our constituents and our citizens come in and help us break the legislative deadlock that we have. And so like in creating space for regular people like us to like directly and substantively talk to our policymakers, it doesn't just let us talk to our policymakers. It lets us talk to each other. And so there are a lot of things that like it feels like we have complete partisan deadlock on. But if people sit down and talk to each other and actually like get to know and understand one another, like it's a lot easier to come to consensus, and it's a lot easier to realize that the other person that the news is sort of just like saying is a huge boogeyman actually isn't. Like, and we suddenly understand who our neighbors are, and we come to respect them and love them a little bit more, which means like we're able to, like, by building the space, we build the space to create consensus and govern ourselves the way we're supposed to, because we care about each other. So yeah, we're going to make this work. Places in the US are starting to, like, there are pockets of places starting to figure it out and starting to see the value and starting to go, yes, we need this. And it's not just liberal spaces. It's not just like the big cities that are doing this. It's communities all over. And so I'm hopeful. I'm really hopeful.
So you mentioned you have a bit of a civic background. Do you want to talk a little bit about how you got into that as well as kind of working with tech?
I was a philosophy and political science major in college. And as a lot of political science majors do, after graduating, I moved to DC, I interned on the Hill, I worked for a science policy nonprofit, and I was doing a lot of science policy and science advocacy stuff. This was back in 2007, 2008. I worked on projects like the first and only presidential candidate, presidential surrogate science policy forum, where we brought in surrogates from the Obama and McCain campaigns, who were advisors to both of them, to debate science policy. I worked on stuff that were training scientists and engineers to run for office. Worked on a thing before it was cool to... it was a day-long session at the American Mathematical Association annual conference, a full-day session on redistricting policy. So we were bringing in mathematicians and lawyers and policymakers to really think about how do we make redistricting more fair. And so now there are a lot of people talking about using math to make redistricting more fair. And we were doing that back in 2009. And so that was cool. And I got to help VintSurf make liquid hydrogen ice cream. And that's also really cool because VintSurf in his cute three-piece suit, with a giant ladle stirring a huge thing of liquid nitrogen, is absolutely fantastic.
Perhaps I should ask, for those who don't know, you want to tell who VintSurf is?
VintSurf, who is now a something, something, something at Google, is the inventor of TCP/IP. So he made the internet work. It's kind of awesome.
Yeah.
And he is always absolutely adorable in a perfectly tailored three-piece suit. It is fantastic.
Kind of reminds me of Bill Nye in that way. I always just love how he's just...
always so dapper.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love it. And no ties.
So from doing that, I was doing the policy and advocacy stuff, but I was also doing a lot of the web stuff because I was always doing internet-y things in high school and in college. And so from that, I sort of, all right, I need to make money. And a lot of organizations, especially a lot of nonprofits, actually need serious tech help. So I started consulting with various nonprofits, helping with their web design and sort of digital strategies. And the more I did it, the more I was like, yeah, I could build you a website, but let's actually step back a bit and think about what you're actually trying to build and whether it's useful. And so that's how I got into UX and content strategy.
So what would you say is one of your favorite projects you've worked on? So either you really enjoyed working on it or it was really challenging or just whatever kind of project was your favorite?
The one that was most interesting to me was a sort of random, it was one of those random viral things that happens. It was last year, actually we're coming up on the anniversary in a couple weeks, a project called Letters for Black Lives. What happened was it was after Alton Sterling was killed by police, and it's not a happy story. But one of the possibilities was that the shooter, the police officer, was an Asian person. And we later found out that he wasn't. Asian communities, particularly Chinese communities, have a history of not necessarily protesting for justice, but A lot of us were going, oh no, we can't have this argument of like, we need to protect a Chinese police officer with our families again, because that is just a shitty argument to have. And like, we needed, so my now friend, Christina Shi, who's an ethnographer in New York, sort of sent out a tweet that said, we need to talk to our families about anti-blackness. And she tweeted out a link to a Google Doc that went, friends, and she was just thinking like a couple friends would help her write it. Let's write this letter to share with our families. And like within a few hours, it became this huge, ginormous thing that hundreds of people were contributing to. And I joined a couple hours later and like sort of became part of the core team that was sort of in the background, sort of trying to manage the infrastructure for how do you get a couple hundred people writing a 300 word letter together. Because like, it was the first internationally viral Google Doc project. And like, we have a lot of them now. Like, Indivisible started as one. And like, so we were sort of like hanging on going, oh my goodness, Google Docs just crashed, because once you hit 200 people, it just stops letting people in. That evening, like, we finished up a English version of the letter. And immediately there were like a dozen teams translating the letter into their own languages. And when I say translate, normally in business speak, when you translate a thing, it's mostly word for word, or you get the meaning, or you get the meaning down. Yeah. But because these were being translated by communities for their own family and for their own communities, the letters weren't just being rewritten in another language. They were being rewritten for a particular community. So, like, so refugee communities talked about the intersection of colonialism and anti-blackness. Communities that had clashes with black communities talked about, yeah, we have a difficult relationship, but. And like, so it wasn't only being like written broadly to a general population. It was like, because we were able to do it together with hundreds of us together, we ended up doing a thing that none of us could have like written by ourselves, but were written particularly for our families. When it was being shared around a lot, we'd get stories, because I was one of the people running the social media for it. We were getting stories of like siblings sharing it on their Facebook wall and saying, hey, let's share this with mom and dad after dinner and like have a conversation. Earlier we were talking about like technology, about like expanding inclusion, and like, this is one of those things where like we think about technology mostly as like generalizing to scale up. But in this case, it was scaling up by not by generalizing, but by like being able to write for a particular and like being able to do a thing that like reaches to making change around the dinner table, like literally around the dinner table. And when I think about social justice and how we create change, like cultural change, like we have to hit that dinner table. We have to get to those dinner table conversations. And Letters for Black Lives was able to do that at scale, which I still think about how it, like, that changed a lot of how I think about my work in content strategy and our work in tech.
And I love that story, just because, again, like, it's amazing to hear not just like we built a bigger, better thing, but this is like we built a thing that has expanded so far and wide. and affected so many people in good ways too, that I don't know, I just get like goosebumps just kind of as you're talking about it, which is like, I think, the best use of tech.
Yeah, like empowering individuals to do a thing none of us could have done alone. Was technology as empowerment is a thing I think about a lot and a thing I strive for a lot these days.
You've had this like civic background and the political background. You got you went that route in school and then finally into your career. What did you want to be when you grew up?
A professor. I really wanted to be like, I wanted to teach college students. I really wanted to teach college students.
Anything in particular?
Back in the day, I wanted to teach philosophy. I wanted to teach political philosophy. And then for a while, I wanted to like do sort of political cognition research. So like actually like sticking people into MRIs and like and trying to figure out how we make political decisions, which are all things that are amazingly fascinating and I still care a lot about. But
I'm trying to picture this like small version of you going, I want us to get somebody in an MRI machine and ask them philosophical questions.
I mean, I was a nerdy kid.
So what do you think is one of the like biggest things you've learned from kind of working in the civic sector in tech?
There are no dumb people. Everyone, like, especially since, like, I was starting to suss this out when I was consulting, but, like, especially, like, as I'm talking to a lot of folks who are, like, working in communities and stuff like that, there are no dumb people. Everyone is smart. It's that smarts are domain specific. So, like, yeah, I'm great at content strategy. Yeah, someone else is really great at Python or really great at R or really great at whatever. And then there are people who are really great at like things that we take for granted because we don't know the field. Like every field is every field and every sort of area, every job area basically, or every industry is like practically complex. It's that like if you're not in it, you're not seeing the details of how complex they are. But someone else is in it and they're seeing it and they get it in ways that we get our own fields. And there are no dumb people. Like, everyone is freaking brilliant. It's having the empathy to realize how brilliant people are in their own space and understanding that when we put all of that together, like that's how we understand how to make the change in the world that we all need. Because otherwise we're just going to be using the word just, can't you just do X, Y, and Z when actually it's a lot more complicated than that. And when you ask, why is it more complicated? People really get excited about telling you why things are complicated and like the things they're doing to work through that complicatedness. It's fascinating and nerdy in amazing ways. And it's beautiful to like let someone go on about how they came up with this brilliant decision or how they came up with this to them seems blindingly obvious, but when you look at it from the outside, you're like, there's a Rube Goldberg machine that shouldn't work, and yet it is beautiful. Seeing people in their element like that is one of the happiest making things that like, it's very happy making.
I love kind of how you worded that because it reminds me of one of my English teachers in high school, and I remember distinctly he taught me that the word ignorant doesn't mean stupid. It just means you don't know a thing in a particular area. And, you know, it's like, I'm not stupid if I don't know things from my history class, you know, because history was not my favorite subject. And You know, similarly, it doesn't mean people are stupid because they don't know the same tech stuff that I do. And I've had people tell me, oh, you're so smart, you do computers. Like, well, that's my thing. You know, it's like, I look smart when you only consider that. Similarly, you look smart because you are smart in your own area. And
I used to hate the word ignorant, and now I'm coming back around to loving it. For exactly that reason. Like,
yeah.
A thing that I've been saying a lot recently is ignorance isn't a bad thing. What we want is inquisitive ignorance. Because
I like that.
Inquisitive ignorance is curiosity. And, like, that's what makes amazing things happen. Like, if you're inquisitively ignorant, oh my goodness. Like, that's how you figure shit out. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've been going into, like, so much deep, passionate stuff that I've been having trouble finding a good segue into more questions. And I think the inquisitive part is good because I'm about to get inquisitive with you now, I think.
Okay.
Are you ready? All right.
Rock.
So what's one of the coolest TV shows, movies, any sort of entertainment medium that you've been into lately?
So I haven't been able to budget a Switch, a Nintendo Switch.
Oh, yeah.
But I have been watching and listening and reading a lot of Let's Plays around and like sort of meta commentary around Breath of the Wild. So the new Zelda game.
Yes.
Oh my God, there's so much nerd in it. Like it is. I am also a music nerd. I tend to be a orchestral music nerd. And so I've been like sort of finding people writing about ludomusicology, which is the musicology or the music theory and cultural theory around video games. And there's so much fascinating stuff with Breath of the Wild. Like,
I love that there's a whole set of people that are just like, let's study the music in video games.
It's totally fascinating, like, and necessary cultural critique because, like, I mean, if we think about it, like, video games are a huge bit of entertainment these days, but back in the day, like, opera was the entertainment, or musicals are the Hamilton, like, there's still, like, but we feel fully justified in calling, like, cultural critique for those stuff, like, legitimate and worthwhile, and, like, video games are too, like, they're a huge part of culture, so, like, I've talked about how it's one, like, quintessentially Confucian in that, like, even the way the game is structured is, like, instead of giving you discrete tasks that you have to do to move on, they've built the world and they've built the way you go through, go through the shrines or go through collecting things as sort of, like Buddhist cones, where you have to, like, one thing teaches you or helps you learn broader skills that you take into the world. Or you, while you're doing the big thing, you're also concentrating on the little things, of, like, looking for the little sparkles of a Korok moving around. Or how Debussy called music, the space between the notes. And that's quintessentially what Breath of the Wild is, because the story itself is, like, really sparse, right? But the joy that you find from Breath of the Wild is running from place to place and exploring and like taking your time of, like, appreciating the world. That's how sort of a Studio Ghibli or a Miyazaki film, particularly like My Neighbor Totoro. The important points in those films aren't, like, the chapters aren't broken up by major plot points. They're sort of, it's the transition points that make it, like, joyful of, like, being a child and playing in the afternoon. And that's what makes the thing meaningful. And that's what makes Breath of the Wild meaningful. And like putting all these things together was, yeah. So that's the thing I've been nerding out about a lot.
I feel like our entire conversation pretty much answers this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, because I like to ask it. If we were to go to a coffee shop and geek out on some topic for hours, what would be like that one topic you would geek out about?
So right now it's deliberative democracy. But in general, it's about geeking out about things. Like I like the meta nerding so much.
Yeah, I was about to say, how meta of you?
Because everything is nerdy and it's fantastic. So like I want to learn all the things, and like sometimes people ask me, is there a thing I don't nerd out about? And I used to not really have an answer, except now I do, which is I don't know. I haven't found it yet. Because every time I find a thing, I start nerding out about it. It's terrible because I've just, my pile of things I want to know more about just keeps growing, and I have a limited lifespan, and that sucks.
Too bad you can't do like the newer Battlestar Galactica Cylon thing where you can have more than one of you and there's like this collective mindset. And so all of the Cordelias can learn stuff. And
I have thought about that and I want it to happen. Like, I have set plans for if I only have two of me, who would do what out to about a dozen of me.
Now I feel like I have to ask, how many Cordelias do you feel is the right amount of Cordelias?
Depends on how you define right. Because, like, each of me actually, like, saying that I live in the developed world, each of me actually uses a shit ton of carbon. So, like, if there are too many of me, it actually becomes environmentally unsustainable.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Like, yeah, I don't know.
Maybe that's a research thing. Like, you need to sit down and geek out about, you know, what's the right ratio of as many Cordelias as I need to learn as much as I want versus, like, carbon footprint of that many Cordelias.
I need to do some math.
Can I wait till after the podcast?
Okay, check.
Good. This is ridiculous, and I love it. So if somebody wanted to get into kind of civic tech or the content strategy world, what would you recommend they do, or how would they get started?
The nice thing is civic tech itself is, like, we need more bodies. We straight up need more bodies. And, like, so if you're, like, anywhere in the country, see if you have a Code for America brigade around you. And those are, like, volunteer groups who are usually within cities, like, working with the local community and oftentimes actually with the local city government or local county who actually build stuff that, like, the community needs. And that is a great way to get into civic tech. To get into content strategy, I don't know. Every content strategist I talk to has a completely different story of how they got into here. And young or old or, like, junior or senior, like, all of us have different stories. So, like, start talking to other content strategists or start listening to other content strategists and start doing content strategy. Like, content strategy is still in some ways a young field. We do not have, and I don't think we could ever have, like, a content strategy degree or content strategy program at a university. Like, I don't think that could happen just because, like, it's so varied. Sometimes you're an ethnographer, sometimes you're an editor, sometimes you're a manager, sometimes you're a project manager, sometimes you're you're a designer, and sometimes you're all those things put together in the same room at the exact same time. And so just start doing it. Listen to people's, talk to content strategists, for a lot of us are like on Twitter, and like a lot of content. One of the reasons I got into content strategy is it's in many ways one of the most inclusive areas of tech, and like it has problems, like, and we've been talking about the problems and we're actively trying to like fix it and bring more people in. So yeah, talk to us.
If you had any final words you wanted to say to a podcast audience about anything, just anything inspiring or something inspirational or something like that, advice, what would you want to say?
The thing that like I'm trying to build more into like how I do things is, regardless of where in tech we work, fundamentally our work is about making space for people and like empowering people to do things that they otherwise wouldn't be able to. And that fundamentally, like, and there are two ways to do that. One is by telling people what to do and giving them the tools to do it. Or the other is making space to co-create with people, to listen to people's stories, to understand, not only understand what they need and build for them, but like involve people in making the thing. And that is the thing that I want us to move towards. It's making space for people to tell their own story and making space for the telling of their story to empower all of us to work together. Making space for stories is the thing I want us to do more of, I think.
And then my final question is, if somebody wanted to get a hold of you, what's the best way they could do that? Social media or anything else?
The best way is either Twitter or Mastodon. So for Twitter, it's TheBestSophist. And on Mastodon, it's TheBestSophist@scholar.social.
This has been a wonderfully geeky show with B. Cordelia Yu. Thank you for being on.
Thank you for having me.
It was great. And I've been your host, Sarah Withy, Geeky Girl Sarah on Twitter. And have a wonderful day. And see you next episode. Bye.
Bye.